Chapter 73. Pitt felt inspired and determined, even exhilarated. A deep sense of knowing he had opened a door that had been overlooked for generations acted on him like a stimulant. With an optimism that was not there before, he stood in a small empty pasture and waited for the two-engine jet to float in for a landing. Under normal procedures, the feat would have been impossible. The field was pockmarked by old tree stumps and riddled with dry gullies. The longest flat spot ran no more than 50 feet before ending at a moss-covered rock wall. Pitt had expected a helicopter, and he began to wonder if the pilot had a death wish or had brought the wrong aircraft. Then he watched in fascination as the wings and engines began to slowly tilt upward while the fuselage and tail remained horizontal. When they reached 90 degrees and were facing skyward, the plane stopped its forward motion and began to settle to the uneven ground. Soon after the wheels touched the grass, Pitt walked up to the cockpit door and opened it. A boyish face with freckles and red hair broke into a cheery grin. "Morning, you Pitt?"
"That's right."
"Climb in." Pitt climbed in, secured the door, and sat in the co-pilot's seat.
"This is a VTOL, isn't it?"
"Yeah," the pilot replied. "Vertical takeoff and landing, made in Italy. Shinletti 440. Nice little flyer. Finicky at times. But I sing Verdi to it, and it's putty in my hands."
"You don't use a helicopter?"
"Too much vibration. Besides, vertical photography works best from a high-speed airplane."
He paused.
"By the way, the name's Jack Wessler." He didn't offer to shake hands. Instead, he eased the throttles toward their stops, and the Shinletti began to rise. At about 200 feet, Pitt twisted in his seat and stared back at the wings as they turned horizontal again. The craft began increasing its forward speed and soon returned to level flight. "What area would you like to photomap?" asked Wessler.
"The old railroad bed along the west bank of the Hudson as far as Albany."
"Not much left."
"You're familiar with it?"
"I've lived in the Hudson River Valley all my life. Ever hear of the Phantom Train?"
"Spare me," Pitt replied in a weary tone.
"Oh, okay."
Wessler dropped the subject.
"Where do you want to begin rolling the film?"
"Start at the McGee place."
Pitt looked around the rear cabin. It was void of equipment.
"Speaking of film, where is the camera and its operator?"
"You mean cameras, plural. We use two, their lenses set at different angles for a binocular effect. They're mounted in pods under the fuselage. I operate them from here in the cockpit."
"What altitude will you fly?"
"Depends on the focal lenses. Altitude is computed mathematically and optically. We're set to make our run at 10,000 feet.
The view of the valley from above was heady. The landscape unfurled and spread to the horizons, crisp and green, crowned by spring clouds. From 5,000 feet, the river took on the shape of a huge python crawling through the hills, with low islands sometimes dotting the channel like stepping stones in a small stream. A vineyard country here, and an orchard land, broken by an occasional dairy farm. When the altimeter read 10,000, Wessler made a sweeping turn to slightly west of north. The DeSoto crept beneath, looking like a tiny model in a diorama. "Cameras are rolling," Wessler announced.
"You make it sound like a movie production," said Pitt.
"Almost. Each picture overlaps the next by 60%. That way, one particular object will show up twice at slightly different angles with varied highlights. You can detect things that are invisible from ground level, remnants of man-made disturbances hundreds or even thousands of years old."
Pitt could see very clearly the scar of the track bed. Then it abruptly stopped and vanished into a field of alfalfa. He pointed downward.
"Suppose the target is completely obliterated."
Wessler peered through the windshield and nodded.
"Okay, there's a case in point. When the land over the area of interest was used for agriculture, the vegetation will assume a subtle color difference due to elements foreign to the native soil composition. The change might be missed by the human eye, but the camera optics and enhanced color tone in the film will exaggerate features in the earth beyond reality."
In no time at all, it seemed to Pitt, they were approaching the southern outskirts of New York State's capital. He gazed down at the ocean-going cargo ships docked at the port of Albany. Acres of railroad tracks fanned out from the storage warehouses like a giant spider's web. Here the old rail bed disappeared for good under the heavy foot of modern development.
Let's make another run, said Pitt. Coming around, acknowledged Wessler. 5 more times they swept the fading New York and Quebec northern tracks, but the faint, fragile line through the countryside still looked solitary, undivided by discernible offshoots. Unless the cameras spotted something he couldn't detect, the only hope he had of finding the Manhattan Limited was Heidi Milligan. The maps had vanished from the portfolio in the Railroad Museum, and Heidi had no doubt who had stolen them. Shaw had returned to the hotel later that night, and they had made fluid and gentle love until early morning. But when she awoke, he was gone. Too late, she realized that he had listened in on her conversation with Admiral Sandecker. More than once, during their lovemaking, she had thought of Pitt. It was very different with him. Pitt's style was consuming and savage, and impelled her to respond with savage intensity. Their time in bed had been a competition, a tournament that she never won. Pitt had drowned her, left her floating in a haze of exhausted defeat. Deep down it galled her independent ego, and her mind refused to accept his superiority, and yet her body hungered for it with sinful abandon. With Shaw, the act was tender and almost respectful, and she could control her responses. Together they nurtured each other. Apart, they were like two gladiators circling, scheming for an opening to defeat the other. Pitt always left her spent and with a feeling she'd been used. Shaw was using her, too, only for a different purpose, but strangely it didn't seem to matter. She longed to come back to him like someone returning from a stormy voyage. She sat back in a chair in the library room of the museum and closed her eyes. Shaw thought he had forced her into a dead end by stripping the records. But there were other sources of railroad lore, other archives, private collections or historical societies. Shaw knew she could not afford the time-consuming journeys to check them out. So now she had to think of another avenue to explore. And what Shaw couldn't know, couldn't project in his scheming mind, was that she wasn't trapped at all. "Okay, Mr. Smartass," she muttered to the silent bookshelves. "Here's where you get yours." She called over the yawning curator, who was still grumbling about inconsiderate FBI agents. "I'd like to see your old dispatch records and logbooks." He nodded cordially. "We have cataloged samplings of old dispatch material. Don't have them all, of course, too voluminous to store. Just tell me what you want, and I'll be happy to search it out for you." Heidi told him, and by lunchtime she had found what she was looking for.